Hello and welcome to the Beyond podcast. And today we are going to be talking, specifically we're going to be talking about Love's Victory, a play that has been recently performed and recorded for your online delectation and delight, but also more generally about women writers in the early modern and even possibly earlier periods. And I have two wonderful guests with me today to discuss this play and other plays and the process and the changes and the thoughts that go around the changing world of early modern drama in this area. So today I have two guests, and so I will ask them, who are you and what is your purpose in life?
Okay, my name is Alison Finlay and I'm Professor of Renaissance Drama at Lancaster University. And I work in the Department of English Literature and Creative Writing, not drama. So doing drama is a bit extra.
And I'm Emma Rucastle. I'm a freelance theatre director and creative practitioner based in Lancaster.
So before we dive into Love's Victory, as it were, let's just get a little bit of context how you got here. So I'm aware of various projects in the past, but if I start with Professor Findlay, how have you entered this realm, as it were?
Well, please call me Alison. My work on women's drama actually started a long time ago in 1994 in a collaborative project to challenge the received critical idea that these plays written by women before Aphra Behn were, quote, unperformed, quote, not intended for performance, and therefore, quote, unperformable. So Stephanie Hodgson Wright, Gwenna Williams and I staged three early modern plays by women. I staged The Concealed Fancies by Cavendish and Brackley. Steph staged The Tragedy of Mariam. And Gwenno staged The Convent of Pleasure by Margaret Cavendish. And they proved eminently performable. And that label, closet drama, that had been applied to them, meaning unperformable, obviously wasn't true. So indeed, we found out that they actually rely on non-verbal languages, the languages of theatre, to make meaning. And that led to a co-authored book, Women in Dramatic Production, 1550 to 1700. And then for me, onto a personal study of the alternative places, great households, gardens, courts, convents and cities in which women created performances. And that was called Playing Spaces in Early Women's Drama. And that was published by Cambridge in 2006.
So, Emma, how have you entered this sphere?
Well, I think really largely via Alison. I've worked with her on a number of projects, probably the first most significant of those being Iphigenia at Aulis, Lady Jane Lumley's 1557 play. And we did this with the Rose Company, who was a classical all-female company based in Lancaster. And Iphigenia at Aulis was our first performance piece. We took it to an academic conference at Reading University in 2013. And then after that, early 2014, we toured to Cambridge University and University College London, and also did a Northwest tour with the text using small theatre spaces in Manchester, Liverpool, Preston and Lancaster Castle. And it was a fantastic beginning for me at looking at these, as Alison said, plays initially that were called unperformable and discovering, in fact, they were incredibly performable, tourable, and had a lot of very strong audience responses.
Yes, if we start with Iphigenia, it's a really interesting text, partly because of its relationship with the Euripides play and the changes that are made there, but also just the intensity and also some of the questions in staging it, which is a case of who is on when in certain instances. I mean, it gives you certain cues and certain pieces of information, but then it sort of also doesn't, and it gives you room to bustle, I think, as a producer. In a sense, how did that production come together? What was it sort of doing with the text?
I think in some ways I was surprised how faithful you can be to what's there on the page. And how much interrogation the characters stand up to and the relationships. As it was an all-female piece, we played a lot with the idea of masculinity, the argument between the brothers, the fatherhood and daughterhood, lots of conversations around that. Our chorus, we had varying numbers, actually. I think a single chorus at one point, and sometimes three women or four women performing, and certainly referring to what you were saying about who's watching where, we had the chorus ever present, and very much breaking the fourth wall, really, for want of a better term, engaging with the audience about their thoughts about what was going on and their sadness about the tragedy that was ever unfolding. And their relationship to Iphigenia herself, I think, was really interesting as these women watching on.
Yeah, Iphigenia sort of went into their little group, didn't she, and came out of that group a lot of time. And yes, they looked after the baby as well. They looked after Orestes, didn't they?
That's right, Orestes. I'd forgotten, yes, our wonderful prop baby, who, as you say, actually was an important part of the visual aesthetic, as well as giving some heart to the relationships that way.
Yes,
that was the bit where people cried most, was with Iphigenia and Orestes, wasn't it,
in
that scene? Yeah. Mm.
And Orestes, within the, you know, if you're just looking at it as a text, you sort of note, every so often they reference, oh, here he comes, here he goes. You know, you're never quite sure where he is supposed to be at any given moment. But if you look at it as a visual thing, as something that is present, it changes the way the text functions. And, we start off from an audio perspective, so we to a degree we can slightly step aside from that. But when you actually put it on stage, that has a tremendous shift in what's going on.
Did you have any crying, Robert?
Do we have any crying?
From the baby?
From the baby. In the final edit is still... there is an edit. There might be some tweaks. There is some baby that we did go for baby sounds. But how prominent that... I'm waiting for the director to get back to me about the edit as to whether it's too much or too little. Because, yeah, we didn't have an actor just going, wow, or anything. We have got some genuine baby sounds in there. But the difference between the what the chorus is doing in Lumley's version, because the chorus is truncated quite a lot. You don't have the as many of the scene breaks being a lengthy choric speech. It's much more an occasional comment, an occasional moment, which is one of the reasons why you can't really let the chorus leave the stage, because it's so occasional in a different way to what Euripides was doing. So it's a very different version and a very different world. Feel free to contradict me, by the way. I will just whittle.
No, I completely agree.
It was fun having women playing Menelaus and Agamemnon as well, and developing that relationship between them, and those flexing those actor muscles for the two actors that play that, who were both very good, I thought.
At the end of the play, I don't know whether you can say that for certain about your production, but does the production buy the story at the end of the transformation? Is that a real event or is that a lie? Did the production come to a decision on that? Or because that was one of the big questions we had, is any of this true? I mean, it's obviously there in the text to a degree. But did you come down on any one side, or did individual characters come down on one side? Did Clytemnestra buy the tale?
We went very symbolic with the actual transformation, and no, I don't think Clytemnestra did. I'm not sure we hammered too hard any what we felt the audience should feel at that point. I think I wanted to sort of keep a fluidity there in terms of what their belief sort of system was. But I think, Clytemnestra certainly at the end was not not happy and not convinced, I think, by what had gone on.
Well, even if she was, she still thought that Agamemnon was totally wrong.
Absolutely.
That marriage was never going to work.
Yes.
And of course, she's still never going to see her daughter again.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's still a loss.
And
it's like, oh, here is this sweetener for this horribly bitter pill. And you go, still not swallowing it. Right, let's move on to Love's Victory. So how did that come about? And actually, just a little bit about how did it come about? Let's start there.
Okay. Well, in coming about, it started in 2014 when I got the support of the Viscount de Lisle and Patrick Spottiswood of Globe Education to do a staged reading of Love's Victory at Penshurst Place, which was the home of the author, Mary Roth, who grew up as Mary Sidney. In 2018, I was awarded an Arts and Humanities Research Grant for a full production in the Great Hall, which was staged and filmed But unfortunately, the director refused to give me permission to publish it. And that really felt like a repetition of what Roth had experienced 400 years before, when Sir Edward Denny had attacked her for publishing her romance, The Urania, in 1621, and she was forced to withdraw it, though, you know, production copies did get around. I had to fight until December 2021 to do a replacement production, and this time I was able to choose Emma to direct it. So that was really good.
Yeah, and I was obviously absolutely delighted to be asked to do it. We advertised for local actors. Well, I say local actors, we advertised for actors and gathered a really strong cast of largely northern professional performers and rehearsed for a full month at Lancaster University. We did a public dress rehearsal at Lancaster Castle on the Saturday before. We used the Lancaster suite there, and we then drove en masse, actors in a minibus driven by my husband and Alison and her husband in a car packed to the gills with costume, props, etc., down to Penshurst for the rehearsal and filming. Yeah, the costumes, I think I should say, were all hand-sewn by a fabulous costume team, and Alison taking all of us down there and getting us into the space was tremendous. It was a wonderful place to perform, the Baron's Hall. It was freezing. This was late September, wasn't it?
It was.
So not dead of winter or anything, but it was so cold during the main rehearsal day, the dress rehearsal and main day, that we had to go and buy heat packs for the actors to wear under their clothes for the evening performance. It was bone chilling, but the atmosphere was obviously absolutely right for the kind of performance we were presenting. And yeah, I think it was a real special experience of a day.
I really want to pick up on that point about, you know, the repetition and access, because I think one of the big problems that we face, you know, as a concept of what we do, is the problem of every show is sort of, oh, it's rarely or it's never performed, or it's not available, or you can't find it, and the importance of actually saying, well, no, actually, let's create a world where you can watch these plays, where they are available, and that is not a barrier to them being done again. If they are an incentive for them to be done again, we're creating a world where it is easier for the next production of Love's Victory or Iphigenia or any of these plays to come around. And so I'm really, really pleased that you fought to do it again, because there is now a video that can be shared and can be seen, and that's absolutely, you know, wonderful.
And now that we've got a published edition of it as well, that makes it more accessible. And also, I mean, we're hoping that there will be more productions. I mean, that's just one attempt at it, you know, in the place where it was probably composed. But what happens when you put it on a stage like the Wanamaker or the Globe or Shakespeare North Playhouse or a Proscenium Arch Playhouse? You know, what changes in the dynamic? It'd be really interesting to find out. So I hope more productions will happen.
And yet the change in context, the moment you put something in a different context and for a different audience, will a different audience take out of the text? So let's talk a little bit about the text itself, the author. What is the play doing? What was it trying to do then? What might it be trying to do now? Those are quite broad topics. They're nice and straightforward. But yeah, can you tell us a little bit about the play itself in its own time?
Okay, well, shall I start with a bit on Mary Roth herself?
Or I think so, yeah.
Your kind of audience already know that?
I think a little précis would be helpful. Yeah,
okay. So Mary Roth was born Mary Sidney, as I said before, and she was the niece of the pioneering Renaissance writer Sir Philip Sidney, and she was daughter to his younger brother, Robert Sidney, who inherited the Sidney family home, Penshurst Place, after Philip's death in 1587. About 9 months before Mary was born. And Mary grew up in an amazing literary coterie where both men and women were encouraged to write. So a bit like the Shelleys or the Brontes, but 200 years before. And her father wrote sonnets and pastoral lyrics. Her aunt, Lady Mary Sidney Herbert, the Countess of Pembroke, wrote poetry, some of it site-specific. She translated Petrarch. She translated a French tragedy by Robert Garnier into English, which was the first English dramatisation of the Antony and Cleopatra story, the tragedy of Antony. And then the Countess of Pembroke's son, William Herbert, who became Mary Roth's lover, also wrote poetry. And the first scholarly edition of his poetry is going to come out this December. Roth herself wrote sonnets and lyrics, and she had an immense two-part prose romance that she wrote called The Countess of Montgomery's Urania, which is dedicated to her sister-in-law. The first part was published in 1621, causing some scandal. As I've said, Sir Edward Denny, who felt that Roth had satirised him in the book, responded with a counter-literary libel, a poem, calling her a hermaphrodite in show, indeed a monster. So it's perhaps not surprising that Roth didn't publish the lengthy second part that remained in manuscript, and that's in the Newbery Library in Chicago. Her play then, Love's Victory, probably written between 1617, 1619, possibly slightly later, likewise exists only in manuscript. In fact, there are two manuscripts, one in the Huntington Library in California, that's in the public domain, which has some pages missing at the beginning and at the end. That was one of the exciting things I found out talking to the curator, that she could see where the glue was there for the pages to be tipped in, and in fact, they've been removed. So there's that one. And then there's the so-called Penshurst manuscript, which is privately owned by the Viscount de Lisle. And that's a neater copy, and it's beautifully bound in an embossed leather cover whose monogram suggests that it was a presentation copy that Roth presented to her cousin and lover, William Herbert. So her play then grew out of a host of other literary and dramatic activity. And in fact, even Robert Sidney had done a play, well, a pastoral entertainment, The Lady of May, which would be another good one to put on the list of your eccentric pieces of writing to perform, I think. Mm. In 1603, her father, Robert Sidney, was appointed the Chamberlain to Queen Anna of Denmark, the wife to King James, which meant that he was in charge of organising the entertainments or revels for Anna's court. And Lady Mary Roth danced alongside Queen Anna in Ben Jonson's Mask of Blackness on the 6th of January 1605 as one of the daughters of Niger. And for the winter court season and at other times, the Sidneys lived with their siblings and their cousins at Baynard's Castle in London, the Pembroke's London house. And the Pembrokes were by that time the richest family in England. So, you know, there was a lot of proximity to the court and court affairs. And I think Mary Roth's proximity to the court, watching some of her cousins and her sister performing in court masks, for example, all feeds in to Love's Victory.
Yes, we're still getting there when it comes to doing the royal entertainments and masks. But we are slowly working our way through them. we're almost done with the Elizabethan in its entirety. But then you hit the meat grinder, shall we say, of the Jacobean. There's just so much stuff to do. It's never ending. So the text itself, and as okay, a performance text, I don't know whether I want to go to Emma on this, you know, as a practical text to work with, or texts to work with, what sort of questions and staging things come out of that? Because you've got interactions with music and other elements.
Absolutely. And I think you just started to touch on it slightly there with the idea of Love's Victory itself. I think one of the big questions we had throughout was which of the characters do in fact experience and achieve Love's Victory? Where does that happen within the text? Because the whole text, as you no doubt know, dramatised like the romantic entanglements of shepherds, shepherdesses, and as you say, singing songs, telling riddles, all overseen really by the deities of Venus and Cupid. And who exactly achieves this romantic, happy, romantic ending of Love's Victory? Or in fact, is that what Love's Victory is? Does it have to be a pairing off or a sort of neat and tidy victory at the end? That was one of our major talking points throughout.
It is a kind of revenge play as well. I mean, it's Venus and Cupid's revenge on the mortals for being very, very insouciant about love, just not caring about love and thinking it's not important. So Venus and Cupid come in and make them all suffer. And as a result, when they do all suffer and fall in love, then it is their kind of victory as well.
Yeah, and in our version, we doubled Cupid and Arcas. So this kind of, yeah, revenge and coming in and really altering the course of some of the love's actions within the play, and the sort of path of true love through the play for some of the characters was very actively done by Arcas as Cupid, and knowingly so. And we felt that was a really interesting way of presenting some of these other ideas of, yeah, revenge and power and who exactly is in control of destiny.
Yes, because Venus and Cupid are rarely presented in a nice way, shall we say, in early modern drama. They are deeply ambiguous figures, and they are often forces of not just chaos, but sometimes quite malignant forces. And it varies from play to play. But this idea of uncontrolled, you know, love and desire it seems to be a dangerous theme. And also just on sort of the nature of genre here, you know, we're talking about pastoral things, and people today often think of pastoral as being idyllic landscapes and things, but as a genre it's often filled with violence and danger in a way that I think modern audiences don't always appreciate before they go in or look at a text.
I think that mode of pastoral tragicomedy that became popular in the Jacobean period as well really fits into that. I mean, that goes back to Tasso's Aminta and Guarini's Il Pastor Fido. Those plays are tragicomedies. You know, things get very dangerous. Characters die or nearly die, and are then miraculously revived. And the darker side of pastoral adventures definitely is something that, you know, Roth picks up, I think, from that tradition, I think. I mean, she's, as Barbara Lowalski said, she wasn't just part of an isolated courtly environment. She does seem to have known what was going on in the public theatre, probably due to Ben Jonson, you know, influencing her quite considerably.
And I think we consciously did lean into the real sort of darkness, at the tragedy, of the sort of double sacrifice. I felt it was strongly there in the text, and although it then does lighten and brighten up again towards the end when we get Venus coming in and effectively bringing the characters back to life, I didn't want to sort of shy away from the darkness of the moment of their deaths.
So into the production itself, you've sort of given us a rough outline of sort of, you have rehearsals, you go down to the place you performed it. I mean, in terms of pulling together in rehearsal, working with the text, making those decisions as you go, or maybe you made a lot of prearranged decisions based on the text. How did you arrange that rehearsal time and create the production?
Well, first of all, there was the text itself. I needed the permission of the Viscount de Lisle to use the Penshurst manuscript because it belongs to him. So the stage reading in 2014, I was really lucky to get that. And then I was lucky to get permission to edit it, which I did in collaboration with his son, Philip Sidney, and with Professor Michael Brennan, who had been entrusted with editing the privately printed Roxbury edition in 1988. So that was the first stage. And because Penshurst Place is still the Viscount de Lisle's Sidney family home, we also were very grateful to the Sidney family for giving us permission to hire the Baron's Hall to use that great medieval hall as a venue to read, first of all, and then stage the play. Making the production site-specific was really important to me because the house and the gardens, which remain largely the same, are such resonant contexts for the composition of Love's Victory, I think. I mean, it can be read one way. It's not the only way to read it, but it can be read semi-autobiographically as a tragicomic happy ending to Roth's own romance with her cousin, William Herbert, the staging of kind of a possible happy future in which Love's Victory could be achieved after they'd been parted by being married to other people. So I felt Penshurst Place was really important for that reason. as a place to do it. And in our dressing room, for example, the figure of William Herbert looked down on us from a painting as we got ready, and the high table where the actors got up from to perform, we put them at the formal end of the hall, was the same table at which generations of Sydneys, including Roth, would have sat and risen to dance or play or perhaps perform in Love's Victory. That was really important, and I think music was too. And you've already talked to Tamsin Lewis, who did the music, but that added so much to the resonance, thinking about what kinds of music the Sydneys had such familiarity with as listeners and practitioners in the production. And we didn't have that in the 2018 one, so that was a big plus for this production.
Yes, and if you want to listen to Tamsin, there is a link in the show description to that little chat where we did talk about some of the musical choices that were involved there. Emma, about the pulling together of the production, what was your rehearsal process like?
I think in most ways very similar to any text, really. So lots of initial warming up, learning to get to know the characters, to get to discuss relationships. Having Alison in the rehearsal process throughout meant the actors got a lot of one-on-one time there, talking about the links to the Sydney family and the links to the history, which played in, I think, to the way we performed as a whole. As Alison said, we had the actors ever present on stage around the family dinner table, really, and they were to some extent playing family characters first, and then standing up, moving into the performance area, just not quite proscenium arch, but end on a lot of the time, although we did have the actors moving through the whole space as well to break the fourth wall and to talk to the audience for part of this. So I think really the rehearsal process was, yeah, relationships, blocking, refining, working. It's breaking down moments from any rehearsal process, I think, is often quite difficult. But it did follow a pattern that sort of grew organically, really, but did, I think, in the end, both lean into the comedy and the tragedy that we've already talked about, but this idea that with this group we found the sort of depths of despair as well as the lighter and more comedic ensemble, really, I think, yeah.
Maybe it's worth talking about the audience a bit as well, because they were kind of collaborators and collaboration from them was important. Recreating a Sydney Herbert household, as we were trying to do sort of by doing it at Penshurst, that's impossible. So the only thing we could do really was kind of recruit the next best thing, a kind of coterie of academic writers and their relations who knew so much about the Sydneys, the Herberts and all their other writings. And we kind of recruited them as delegates to a two-day conference, which was happening at the same time as the performance at Penshurst, organised by Philip Sydney and me, and supported with the collaboration of the staff at Penshurst Place itself. And so the performance followed a day of papers, readings, music, and a tour of Penshurst. So the people who actually came to see the performance were fully immersed in Sydney words, music, paintings, architecture by the time they saw Love's Victory.
So how did the performances go? I mean, were there any surprises? Were there things that worked, the things that didn't work? Were you... I mean, obviously, Alison, you've seen two performances, different productions. I can come to you for a comparative assessment there. But yeah, how did the performances go?
I think the first very pleasant surprise, really, was at the public dress rehearsal, which didn't in the end feel like a dress rehearsal at all. It really did feel like a performance. And we performed that, as I think I mentioned, at Lancaster Castle in the Lancaster Suite, which is not the largest of rooms. And so the audience was really very close into the action in a different way to the way they were at Penshurst. And I think watching them be drawn into the story, and particularly I remember the response to the suicide, the Musella Phyllises, and the audience were just silent in that deep way audiences sometimes are when you recognise they have been shocked, they have been moved. And that was a really strong moment for me to recognise that I believed we'd got the kind of power in that moment that I was hoping for. That was a first really nice experience of a non-performance, because the pressure was off, really, as I say, it was a dress. But nevertheless, it did in fact feel like that. And so to take that then into Penshurst itself, I think initially Penshurst felt very big. And that was, although we'd all, during rehearsals, we had blocked it out and measured out the space. After the quiet, close intensity of the dress at Lancaster, taking it into the larger space was something of a challenge, which throughout the rehearsal day and a half, I think we grew to enjoy the space to play, really.
Just coming in on the Musella and Felicity's suicide, I mean, the fact that actors, the rest of the Shepherd community, were interspersed between the tables where the audience members were sitting, I think created that sense of intimacy as well. And those, I mean, they were wonderful actors, the whole company. Their tangible shock and grief amongst the Shepherd community, I think, proved contagious for spectators as well. So it really worked for me in the bigger space too. I thought there was also, I mean, I thought, as I said before, I think the music, in comparison to the first production where we didn't have early modern music, we had composed music. The music this time was just added so much to the whole thing and really helped to give texture to the high moments, the low moments, the comedy within it. Sympathy for Rustic, I thought, was quite palpable as well because of the kind of musical fun that had surrounded him throughout.
Yeah, with Rustic, absolutely. And we sort of worked quite hard to find, I suppose, the truth almost in the Delina and Rustic at the end. We didn't want it just to be an absolute pairing off because there were couples required at the end, as it were. And we did look throughout for sort of off-centre moments, lots of off-centre moments, not just with that couple, actually, but one of my pet hates is crowds all responding in a similar way to a reaction happening. So we looked throughout among the sort of group of shepherds and shepherdesses, really trying to find the individual characters and the way they responded, and who knows what when, who knows about the betrothal with Musella and Rustic, and at what point is that actually common knowledge, or who's heard rumours of it, and some of that played into the earlier scenes too. And I think because we had an audience in Penshurst in particular, as Alison said, who were very knowledgeable about the play and the text, it was pleasing how many of these off-centre moments were also noticed by them. They really enjoyed Lysias as well. They really enjoyed his a comedy that we found in it. The actor playing Lysias is a very talented actor with a great deal of range, but when he really recognised, as actors too, what audiences are responding to, he really sort of played into this, I think. Lysias was a big favourite, as we discovered at the question and answer session the following day. A lot of the audience were asking about him and his path through the play, really.
And the fact that he was so charismatic made him, I think, a bit like the William Herbert figure in early modern England, you know, in Jacobean England, who was, you know, an incredibly desirable person at the court. The centre of attraction, really charismatic. Matthew Christmas, who played Lysias, really brought that out, I think.
I mentioned earlier the doubling of Cupid and Arcas, again, something that I really enjoyed working with, and I do feel worked within the text. One of my favourite moments really is right at the end, because earlier in the play, Cupid had actually had time to, we had, you know, really well-dressed Cupid and put on an Arcas costume. And at the end, there just isn't the physical time for that. So he just sort of waved his hat at the audience, the big hat that he'd been wearing as Arcas, and broke the fourth wall in a very sort of Brechtian way, really. And again, the audience made it clear through their reaction that they absolutely understood what was happening in that moment. And there were sort of various levels of theatre and actor, performer, performers, characters going on, which was something I really personally enjoyed.
Just going back, if I can, to Musella and Felicity's as well. Musella and Felicity's, when Simina says, "What have you killed them?" I think that is a real moment of shock for the audience, because they think that, you know, Sylvester's just given them a potion and they're going to, you know, magically revive again. And then when Simina says, "What have you killed them?" That was a moment that was registered by the audience as well as Sylvester at that point, you know, and Simina at that point, that it had killed them, even though perhaps it wasn't meant to. And I don't think Sylvester knew that it was a potion that Venus had prepared in our production. I think she really believed she had killed them.
Yeah, agreed.
For the listeners at home, of course, we haven't really been explicating what's going on in the play, but that's partly because you can go and watch it, and that's great. So anyone who's a bit lost with what we're talking about here, I'm sorry, but you know it's there. Just go. And having mentioned that, you know, you can go out and watch it, we now have the digital dimension. You have the live audience and their feedback. Do you get any feedback or sense from, you know, having put it out there in the digital world? And whether any sort of thoughts about that come to you. Are there things that come across better on video, or things that maybe has been missed in the translation between the two?
I think for me, the off-centre moments I mentioned come across well on the film. Working with Martin during the day, he was very keen to find out some of the backstories we put into the characters and some of these moments of response, and I feel he has chosen in many cases some really nice close-ups or mid shots of various ensemble moments, and brought out for the audience some of these different responses to things that were going on.
Mary Ellen Lamb, who watched the film, she couldn't get to Penshurst to watch the performance, but she said there were some specific moments that struck me. I'm reading from what she wrote here. One was near the beginning of the play, when Sylvester actually sits down at one of the tables and confides her otherwise soliloquy to audience members there. And she says the fourth wall disappeared. And that was due to Martin Hollingworth's decision to do a real close-up of her sitting down at the table. And so you got a nice little shot of the round table and Sylvester just sitting on one of the chairs there. The drones were good as well. Yes, the use of a drone to give a kind of godlike perspective. In addition to those close-ups, we had, after Musella and Phyllis had committed suicide, Martin used the drone to do a shot from above. So we got them lying down on the hearth at the floor at Penshurst Place. And that hearth is actually a fire, usually. So all those references to fire and martyrdom and Sylvester being burnt that the Forrester imagines were kind of realised in that one shot that he took, for me anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. And just back to the fourth wall moments, we didn't have any actors talking directly to camera. So I suppose to some extent, the breaking of the fourth wall often was lost on film. But as Alison said, with some really well-chosen shots, I think that dimension of it is still there. Yeah.
Mm. It really does. It's one of those big questions about, you know, when you're filming a thing, you know, because of course a locked off wide shot just doesn't give you that connection that theatre gives you, and trying to find those compromises and those moments to go in close and those moments to pull back.
Part of the problem is you kind of want the film audience to experience the space as well, and so there's a temptation to use loads of wide shots so you can see loads of Baron's Hall at Penshurst, but of course that it just doesn't work in the same way.
And that was one of the other, well, I say little quirks of Penshurst, is it sits below a flight path. Quite often, again, we were looking, and that was why we did quite a lot of filming during the dress rehearsal as well, to make sure we had as clean an audio as possible. And again, I think Martin and his collaborators did really, really rather well with that, because it's not the easiest of spaces that way. Yeah.
We did have Venus and Cupid going up to the Minstrel's Gallery as well, which I know was difficult, Emma, but it worked.
It did. No, it did. Yeah, absolutely.
We're sort of into closing thoughts now. I mean, obviously, this has been done, and we're always here to encourage people to, you know, keep going back or move on to other but similar or different projects, but in the same sort of area. Have you any future plans that are within this universe, or any final thoughts about the production that is past?
Okay, well, you know that the Revels edition is there now, and it's available in paperback now, so much more accessible for teaching or for indeed doing another production, and I would encourage people to do that. The film is freely available on a website called Shakespeare and His Sisters on Site, and interviews with Emma, with the actors, and with Robin and Tamsin the musical director are going to be added to that as soon as I've got time to edit them and upload them. There's a Sydney Journal number 41 double issue, which contains the papers from the conference by who were members of the coterie audience. That's going to come out in December or probably November 2023. And the edition of poetry that I mentioned by William Herbert, edited by Mary Ellen Lamb, Garth Bond and Stephen May. That's coming out in December from the ITER Academic Press in collaboration with the Renaissance English Text Society, which is a bit of a mouthful, but it's good to have those poems finally in a good scholarly edition because they haven't been since 1660. You know, so about time in that sense.
For me, really, as a freelancer, my work remit tends to be extremely varied. So I've got a community production of Goethe's Faust coming up. And I suppose the nearest thing that might encompass this world is an inclusive theatre Christmas play about time travel, which dips in and out of all different historical periods.
Yes, and mentioning that this is at time of recording, all these things are happening hopefully in the future, and hopefully by the time this goes out, they'll still be happening in the future, or about the same time that this is going out. If you're listening to this in the future, then it has already happened. Links to anything digital will be in the show description. You will be able to follow all of the links that have been mentioned. You will be able to find those things out there.
Can I do a last plug?
Absolutely. Make it as many as you like.
Emma also... directed Edward III, the anonymous play Edward III, at Lancaster Castle last year, which we were really lucky. We got the whole of the castle courtyard to perform in and a wing of the castle. And we did that there in summer, end of May, beginning of June.
Well, all that remains is me to thank my wonderful guests for being wonderful. Thank you very much, everyone, and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you. Bye.